Wisconsin State Patrol Superintendent Steve Fitzgerald retires on Friday, August 5th. He's had a 50-year career almost in law enforcement, and I'm going to check my notes to get it right. Started as a City of Chicago police officer, then police chief in the small village of Eustisford in Dodge County, sheriff of Dodge County for 14 years, U.S. Marshal for the Western District of Wisconsin, and then beginning in February of 2011, superintendent of the Wisconsin State Patrol. Superintendent Fitzgerald, thanks so much for taking time to talk about your career. I really appreciate it.
You're more than welcome.
Let's talk about, take it back to the basics. Why did you decide to become a police officer, sir?
Well, that's kind of ironic because I really didn't want to be a police officer. I wanted to be a fireman. And I had lived across the street from a fire station when I was in grade school and admired the firemen and, got to know some of them personally. And always would take the exam, but I would always get right up to the top but never get hired.
As a firefighter, sir.
As a firefighter. And my wife's two cousins were both Chicago policemen. And they used to kid me and say, why don't you just take the test and become a Chicago policeman? I said, A, I don't want to be a policeman, and B, I certainly don't want to be one in Chicago because I was raised in suburbs of Chicago. But anyway, I finally, to appease them, went and took the test and then got a notification that I would be hired. Went through the academy and found out that it was pretty interesting, and I really have enjoyed the career, and I'm really glad that I ended up being a policeman instead of a fireman.
You remember your first day on the job as a City of Chicago police officer?
I remember the first day going to the academy, and okay. I remember my first day on the road by myself. It was kind of ironic because when we were in the academy, they said, you'll have a field training officer, your first 6 weeks when you're on the road. My first day was Easter Sunday, 1967, and I was a one-man car. I was petrified. I'm sitting out there, please don't call my number, please don't call my number. And then after that, then I was with an FTO after that, and everything leveled out. But so my first day was pretty scary because I was out by myself in unfamiliar territory.
Does policing in 1967 bear any resemblance to policing in 2016, Mr. Superintendent?
I think it does. I think it more than a lot of us realize, because the main thing in police work is the human intervention. I mean, a police officer is intervening with people's lives the same in 67 as they are doing today. It's still got all the inherent dangers that go along with the job. Technology has changed drastically. That's the biggest change that I've seen in the years that I've been here. Communications. A lot of times when I was in Chicago, you were patrolling and you had no communications at all, just because of the constrictions and the availability of equipment that would get around some of those barriers. And over the years, technology has taken over, and now an officer that's on patrol now always has communications with either their headquarters or with other cars that are in the field.
Do you think, in light of recent events, that it's more dangerous than ever to be a law enforcement officer in America, sir?
Some of the incidents that have happened lately have really bothered me, and mainly the ones that really bother me are the ones that where they're deliberately going out and ambushing police officers and ambushing innocent people. I have, for years, tried to ingrain upon the younger police officers that the most dangerous person in the world is a person that doesn't care if they live or die, because they're certainly not going to care about your life. And those are the people that really are the scary part of law enforcement, is because they're very difficult people to deal with, and they can change and become very violent very quickly. So that's something that you have to look at and be able to evaluate very quickly what's going to happen. But to answer your question, things are basically still the same because of the human intervention. I don't think we'll ever get away from that. And yet technology has changed a lot, which changed the complexion of the job too.
Well, you have been dealing, police officers, including yourself, have been dealing with violent individuals for decades. Has the emergence of terrorism and the threat of so-called lone wolves, has that just raised the ante in terms of danger for sworn officers, sir?
It certainly has. It certainly has. And again, those are the people that I try to instill upon the cadets in that those are the dangerous people, because we can't predict what they're going to do, because I don't think a lot of them know what they're going to do until the last minute when they do it. And they're very hard to detect. As you know, we live in a free country. We don't restrict people, and like a lot of foreign countries do. You know, and that makes us more vulnerable, but yet we wouldn't want it any other way. That's what we're fighting for, is the freedom, and this is the greatest country in the world, and we want to keep it that way. So it's a balancing act, a very difficult balancing act sometimes, but one that they have to be able to make the assumptions very quickly about which way the situation is going to go, and sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong.
Is it a tragic fact now in America that a lone wolf could strike anywhere at any public event, sir?
You know, this has been something that law enforcement's worried about for years. You know, you have the big catastrophic events like the World Trade Center.
Yes.
But you also have the smaller targets that can really disrupt society, too. And those are the ones that we are more concerned with today on a local level about, you know, in our own areas right here. And we have enough to worry about right here, to be very frank with you, of these lone wolves or people that are going out on their own, whatever their cause might be. And it's difficult to predict which way these situations are going to go.
Should Wisconsin residents take any additional precautions in light of the lone wolf phenomena, sir?
You know, I just tell people to be vigilant of the surroundings that you're in, you know. And this goes just for not only terrorists, but I mean for just regular run-of-the-mill criminals, if you want, you know, pretty loose term. People that prey on other people, you know, but a lot of times people put themselves in a position that it makes it very easy for somebody to prey upon them, you know, like walking in dark alleys after dark and, you know, walking alone. That's what we, you know, try to tell the students here at the university, don't go out on your own and walk, you know, go in groups, go with people that can, you know, be more visible to the people there, and the people that are going to do harm to you more than you are going to find some other victim and not bother you if you're, you know. But we definitely don't want to give up our freedom. We definitely don't want to give up our right that we have to do what we do, you know, and that's one of the things that we worry about in a free society.
When you have attacks both in Europe and increasingly tragically in America, are the terrorists winning, Mr. Superintendent?
You know, they're only winning if you let them win. You know, I tell people that you just have to be vigilant, you know, and watch what your surroundings are when you're going, but don't let it preclude you from doing things that you really want to do. You know, my wife every once in a while will say something about, you know, if they feel uneasy here or there, and I say, no, you know, you can't let that get to you. You know, you've got to, your life has to go on. You can't live in fear. And I think we live in a very safe society here in the United States. And when you look at the number of people that we have and the number of incidents that we have, it's really a small group, although they attract a lot of attention when they do these things and, right, you know, brings it up to the forefront.
Let's talk about your decision to go from the Chicago Police Department to come to Dodge County, sir.
It was a big leap.
Why did you want?
I enjoyed being a Chicago policeman. It was very challenging.
How many years were you?
Almost 9 years.
9 years.
Yes, and it was a very challenging career. Like I said, I was born in the suburbs of Chicago and lived in a middle class, raised in a middle class family. When I got on the Chicago Police Department, I was put into the high crime areas. And I found out very quickly that a lot of people are not dealt the same cards, that some people have a lot more in life than other people have, you know. And it gave me a different sense of what our responsibilities as humans really are. And I enjoyed working there, but it was very difficult to raise a family in the corporate boundaries of Chicago.
Right.
And you had to live within the city limits. And to afford the house that you would really like, you couldn't do it on a patrolman's salary. So my wife and I have been vacationing up at Long Lake in the Kettle Moraine Forest here for years. My family, we went there when I was a kid, you know, so I've been going up there basically all my life. And I said to her, why are we going back? Maybe we should see if I could find a job here in law enforcement and we could make our home here, you know. Well, we did that, and that was a difficult process in the beginning because I wrote to the different sheriff's departments and you had to have a year's residency before you could join the sheriff's department. And then I found out through a mutual friend that the village of Houstonsford was looking for a police officer. So I went and interviewed for the job and was hired. And I spent just under 5 years there. And I can tell you, in my whole career, that was one of the most challenging jobs that I had.
Were you the only officer?
The only one.
You were the only one.
I used to hold roll call.
Chief and every hold roll call.
In front of a mirror. You know, but it was a big challenge because I had to learn about the people. You know, in Chicago, if you arrested somebody, chances are you never saw that person and you never see him again. In Houstonsford, when I arrested somebody, I knew the whole family. I knew the kids. I knew the mother, father. I knew the dog, you know. And that was a challenge, and it gave you a sense of that you had to be totally fair with these people because you're going to be living in that same community with yourself. And I learned that there were some terms, and it's only 160 miles geographically from one point to the other, but there was a big difference in some of the language that that they used, you know, so I had a little learning curve there, so it was a challenge.
You went from a working high-crime precinct in Chicago to a small rural
right. I went
village.
From a 13,000-person police department to a one-person police department, and it was, like I say, it was a challenge. It was a challenge for my family.
Yes.
It was a challenge for myself. Both of my sons said when they're 18, they're going to move back home. One's in his 50s, the other's in his late 40s, and they haven't left yet, so I don't think they're going anywhere. But it turned out that we picked one of the greatest states to move to. We have never regretted that move. My wife and I often talk about it, and we're very happy that we made that move.
And then you decided to get a little bit more political and run for sheriff.
Yes, I did, and we were successful on our first run, and that was another chapter in my life, going from being you know, one of the supervisors to being the sheriff was a big leap.
Yep.
One I enjoyed. I enjoy people, so it was a good mix, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was a great job, and I still respect that office, you know, and that's, in our society here today, that's a very respected office and, you know, one that people look up to and you know, I think it's a big part of all of ours because we have the jail where we have to treat people and you also have all of the patrol duties that go along with it, too.
Right. Yeah. And then to the federal government as a U.S. Marshal for the Western District.
That's correct.
Not many people understand what a U.S. Marshal does.
Well, and I didn't either. You know, and one of the other sheriffs asked if I knew anything about the job, and I said, I don't, but I know the gentleman that's in the job. So I called him and had a long talk with him and found out exactly what the job entailed, and I went back to the other sheriff and told him, and he said, well, I'm really not interested. Well, my wife said, maybe you should be interested. So we looked at it, and it was a two-year process to go through the process to be appointed by then Governor Bush. I mean, President Bush. And it was a great honor. And the job is a lot more than people realize. I was right down the street in the federal building right here in Madison, in the Western District of Wisconsin. And you have the protection of all the judicial, all the judges, all of the attorneys that are there, all the people that come and go to that facility. You're also in charge of all the federal prisoners. And we house them at different local jails and then had to bring them for court or whatever. And then after they were sentenced, then it was our responsibility to get them transported to wherever they were going to go into Marshall's system. And then eventually would end up in the penitentiary that they've been designated to. So there was a lot there. And then also you had to serve a lot of different papers and federal papers on people that were going to have to be summoned in for court and that. So there was a lot more to the job than a lot of people realize.
And then the most intriguing thing of all, you became superintendent of the State Patrol. Talk about the mission of the State Patrol before we talk about your career
okay,
there.
Okay, well, let me just say that this was something that I had always admired, the State Patrol. I had, when I was the sheriff, a lot of sheriffs didn't get along with the State Patrol.
I want to ask you about
that. I always did get along with the State Patrol. I always encouraged them to come to Dodge County and assist us any way they could. And I, like I say, I was always attracted to the State Patrol. And I think mainly one of the attractions that I had is because Chicago Police Department is a large, very structured police department, and the State Patrol is a medium-sized department, but with a lot of structure too. And I think I liked that that aspect of it, and that's why I, when I had the opportunity to interview for this position, I didn't hesitate. I did, and was successful and became the superintendent.
Well, one thing that has always intrigued me: the mission of the State Patrol is. Sure, our highways plus. Tell us about the plus, the additional responsibilities,
well,
sir.
Well, and that's changed over the years.
Yep, it's evolved.
You know, it has evolved into, and we're in a lot different areas now where we assist other agencies, you know, and most of our stuff is assisting other agencies. The State Patrol has always had a presence on the county roads and in the counties. And with the super highways that we've built in our state, we've lost some of that personal touch and we've lost some of our identity with the other counties because these troopers and inspectors have been taken and put in different areas where we have a responsibility too, so it's kind of a balancing act. When I came on board, we were down 100 troopers because we hadn't had a class in almost 5 years.
But the authorized strength of the patrol is how many, sir?
401.
401.
Right.
And has that not been changed in a while?
No, that's not been changed, and we have never really gotten to that 401, so it really hasn't been that difficult. We have a class now. Our classes we try to start out with 50. Last class we started out with 51. We ended up with 38 going through the process.
You graduated 38.
Right, we graduated 38. We had 37 retirements. So, I mean, we're just constantly trying to peck away at this, but sometimes it's more difficult than it would seem to be able to keep those numbers up.
So you've never been at the 401 that's authorized?
Not under my term, no.
Well, having covered the Capitol for a few decades, I know every time there's a discussion about raising the 401 cap, there has traditionally been, as you just alluded to, some pushback from sheriff's offices.
You don't see that today as much as you did in the past, and I think it's because of everybody having limited budgets. We have to cooperate with each other a lot more now. And the State Patrol has, because of our nature, have come up mostly with traffic-related. I mean, that's our primary responsibility, although we now end up doing our TRU, our reconstruction unit, that
yes.
is one of our most used units in our agency by other agencies, is where we actually reconstruct traffic accidents or any kind of serious accident that would have something to do with a motor vehicle, whether it's bicycles or cars or boats or whatever it might be. But we also have the responsibility now of crime scenes, where there's hideous crime scenes in that, a lot of evidence that are being recovered in that. Our unit, the TR unit, the reconstruction unit, will go in there and map out the entire scene for a lot of the local sheriff's departments and local police departments. So that's one of our areas that we've evolved into more than we ever were before.
Does the addition of crime scene and reconstruction mean there are fewer troopers out there on the highways checking my speed as I go up north on I-90?
We're very cautious of that, you know, and we watch that very closely, and that's why we have the teams that are strategically located around the state, so that we're not depleting them from other duties that they have. But yes, no matter how you look at it, you know, we have to achieve the jobs that we're looking to, and so, I mean, yes, it does to take away sometimes from it. But it's a necessary evil and something that we excel in, so that's why we continue
One thing that has always intrigued me when I look up annual stats on the patrol is the volume or the number of drugs that the patrol takes off the streets.
Right.
Do you have any recent numbers, maybe for 2015 or anything?
I don't have them for 2015, okay, but I do have them, you know.
The latest numbers that you have, sir?
We break it down into two different areas.
Yes,
one
sir.
Area is when we stop a car for an violation and find the drugs on the person after we stop the
yep.
person.
Yep.
The other one is where we actually find out that they're transporting larger quantities, you know, and it wasn't initiated as a drug stop, it was initiated as a traffic stop, but it ends up being more of that. So
right.
non-traffic offense drug arrests, and just while I use 2013 as an example, we had 1,850 drug arrests. This year, or the last year I have the statistic for, which would be last year, it's up to 2,348.
Let's talk about that now. Is that the last year for which you have the stat for? Is that calendar 2015, Mr. Superintendent?
Right. Yes, it is.
Well, you went from an increase in 2013 from, what's the number, 1,000?
1,850, and then in 15 we had 2,348.
Okay, that's a pretty significant increase.
It really is. And I can give you this year's up to date now.
Please.
Which would be the second, is 1,514. So we're on track to even beat the numbers that we've had before.
What does that tell you about drugs and how they're making their way on state of Wisconsin highways, Mr. Superintendent?
It's not good news. It's not good news. That's why we are working a lot with interdiction right now, where we're trying to catch these people. You know, we have way stations, or SWEPs as we call them today, the safety inspection areas where people come in, especially at our point of entry like Kenosha or Hudson,
yep.
or one of the other areas. That's one of the things that we're looking at very closely, is when these big semis come in and when other traffic comes in, is to have the canine dogs there that are trained to sniff these contrabands and see if we can preclude some of the stuff actually making it into our state. So that's a big responsibility that we have too, and we're doing more in drug interdiction today than we ever have before. That's one of the things that really is different from when I started in law enforcement. We didn't have near the amount or numbers that we had. Even working in the inner city, that we have today. You know, I mean, it's just...
Is the nation losing the war on drugs?
I don't think we're making a whole lot of headway with it. You know, every time, you know, and it's a lot of things that are, it's not a simple problem. You know, you got prescription drugs, you got people that get you know, addicted to prescription drugs, and then they follow up with the illegal drugs because the prescription drugs aren't available. So, I mean, it's a very personal thing. It's a very difficult thing. You see a lot of heartbreak from families that are totally destroyed because of these drugs, you know. But yet we have people that try to legalize stuff, too.
How do you feel about states like Colorado, where they've legalized the social use?
I have to tell you the truth. I shake my head. You know, I just think of all the problems that we have where it's illegal. You're just compounding it, in my estimation, compounding the problem when you legalize the stuff, you know. Okay. And that's a personal opinion, but I think of one that is pretty valid. You know, when I look at it.
Talk to me about Act 10. You arrived in the middle of the Act 10 controversy.
I did.
How close did we come to major injury or damage to the Capitol, given the hundreds of thousands of protesters, sir?
You know, I have to give the people of Wisconsin credit. It was recognized by us very early that the majority of the people who were doing the protest were not professional protesters. They were not people that wanted to incite a riot. They were school teachers. They were other workers throughout the state that felt jeopardized by the Act 10. Mm-hmm. And that was a much easier crowd to handle than one that eventually came in where they had professional agitators that came in. Those were the people that we knew about and we were watching very closely because they were the ones that really incited anything that happened there. I think the majority of people in Wisconsin are good, hardworking people, and they recognize that this wasn't the avenue that was going to really retaliate or change anything that they had seen. So a lot of the people that I talked to personally said, you know, I'm going to go home. I'm not coming back here again, you know. So that was in our favor. Another thing that was in our favor, I think, and one of the things that impressed me in the first couple of days I was here as the superintendent was the way that people respected the troopers. You know, we didn't wear combat uniforms. We wore our regular uniforms. We wore our Stetson, which is our signature. And people recognized us as, I guess, the good guy, quote unquote. And mm-hmm. And they came to us. And, you know, we safely got them wherever they had to go in that. So that was one of the things that I noticed very quickly, that I had just joined a very elite group of people in the Wisconsin State Patrol. And I've been proud of it to this day.
Was it to your advantage that you were able to communicate? I don't know how often you communicated with your son, Scott, the Senate Majority Leader, and your other son, Jeff, the Assembly Speaker?
We didn't talk much during the Act 10 protests at all, no. They were one end and I was at the other end, so no. But, yeah, it was trying times for everybody.
When you hear things like the Occupy movement and Black Lives Matter, well, let me refer to Milwaukee Sheriff Clark at the Republican Convention.
Right.
Said there were elements of anarchy in both those movements. Do you agree with that statement, sir?
Not really. No.
Not really? Okay.
No. No. There's a lot of frustrated people out there, and there's a reason they're frustrated. Is because, you know, they're trying to dig themselves out a hole sometimes, and they just can't get to the top of that. If you look at people as an individual, I don't think there's anybody that wakes up in the morning and says, you know, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. You know, a lot of these incidents just grow, and a lot of times it's hard to predict where they're going to grow or what they're going to do. One of the things law enforcement tries to do is predict, you know, where we're going to have problems, what our problem's going to be.
Yeah.
We just sent 45 troopers out of state for the RNC.
Cleveland?
Yes.
45 troopers?
Right. And that's the
Who
first
Who pays time. The bill? Do we taxpayers
no,
pay we, the bill?
No, okay. No, they paid for everything. But that's the first time the State Patrol, Wisconsin State Patrol, has left the state, and they were actually sworn in as officers there. There's a prime example of one department not having the resources to do it, and then sticking their hand out and ask for help from other departments. And the reason we sent people, and I've been criticized by a couple of people for saying there, the reason we do that is we may need that help someday ourselves. So.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, a big milestone in law enforcement where we are collaborating a lot more now, and I think it's the right move that we can move that way.
Did any troopers go to the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia,
they
sir?
They didn't, no, sir. We were invited to the one but not invited to the other one, and they didn't have the outside At the Democratic convention, they didn't have it. So.
Okay. As a professional law enforcement officer, with your experience, how do you feel when you see the videos of the death of African Americans who are in police custody?
You know, it's very disturbing to me to see the death of anybody, not just, you know, Black Americans. It's a human being that we're dealing with, and we should be colorblind. We shouldn't be looking at, you know, what the color of their skin is or what did they do and how did they do it and why did they do it. A lot of times, there's a lot more to these deaths than what meets the eye. A lot mm-hmm. of times, people with cell phones now, video cameras are taking, you know, pictures of what's happening.
But is that a good trend?
I don't think it is.
Okay.
You know, and it can be, but it you know, and that's one of the things that investigators look for, so that they can establish it. But sometimes it shows the wrong side. You don't get the whole view of what's happening. So it's a two-edged sword.
What about policing with video cams, with officers?
We are looking at that on the State Patrol right now. We have video cameras in all of our cars. Our squads have it. So every traffic stop that we make should theoretically be filmed when it's happening, both audio and visual, which is a big help. It's a big help when you're trying to sort things out. But
So you've got dash cams, but
right.
are you looking at body cams on the troopers, sir?
We're not at a point now where we're ready to make any move on it, but yes, it's technology that's there. So yes, we want to be aware of it and see what's available right now.
Talking about the changes in technology, which has been seismic, as you just said, Dallas police used a bomb on a robot to kill the one who had been killing police officers.
Right.
Did that surprise you?
Very much so.
This agency doesn't have any capability like that, correct?
No, sir.
Can you understand circumstances that would justify using a robot bomb?
Well, you know, and I, this kind of caught me off guard when this incident happened. I've tried to find some things that I can, you know, educate myself with here, but there's not a whole lot out there. It's pretty new technology. It's used by the military, and that's where a lot of our stuff is, you know, comes from, and that's being used. But it's pretty drastic measures, in my estimation, it's very drastic, you know. And I would hope I'd never have to make the call to use something like that. So,
okay, we're almost out of time. I want to respect your time. Just a couple more questions.
Sure.
Has Wisconsin made progress dealing with the endemic problem of drunken driving in Wisconsin over your career, sir?
No.
No?
I'll be very candid with you. No, we've got a long way to go. And it's something
still the problem that it was when you came back to Eustis for it?
I'd be lying if I said it wasn't. You know, I still think that it's a major problem. It has made an impact on the people that go out for a Friday night fish fry. Okay, these are law-abiding citizens that will go out there and say, I'm only going to have one or two drinks instead of the four or five that I used to have. We've made an inroad into those people because they stop and think of what they could lose by having a drunk driving conviction or even potentially killing an innocent person because of their drunkenness, you know. So in those areas we've made inroads, but yet the hard and fast person that really needs our help is, you know, you see four and five, this person's been arrested four or five times for
seven,
the same
eight,
thing.
Seven, eight, 9 times.
Yeah, right, you know. Those are the kind of people that we can't get to, and those are the kind of people that the medical profession and both law enforcement have a major problem with dealing with these people because of the way they act, you know, what they do, and the consequences of their actions is sometimes fatal.
Well, you're not a Wisconsin native, so I can ask you this.
Sure.
What is there about our culture that sanctions so much drinking and binge drinking, sir?
You know, I've tried to figure that out over the years, too, and I've talked to a lot of people. You know, I'm Irish, 100% Irish, and we have a you know, reputation. The Germans aren't far behind us, you know, and I think a lot of it is culture. You know, a lot of it is where it comes from. I don't have a real answer for it. You know, I mean, when you really look at it, it's you know, an individual's choice, and some people that I have met in my career that can drink without having any consequences, and mm-hmm. other people, they just can't stop. Once they take that first drink, they just can't stop.
What about this controversy that emerges in every session that we should criminalize first offense OWI? Should we, sir?
I don't think so. I think that people deserve one chance, one kick at the cat. You know, and again, if it's more than just stop for OWI, if there's other incidents involved with it, then the law kicks in and things change drastically. you know, like if there's physical harm done to somebody on a first offense, then it will escalate up to something differently. But no, I don't think it's really going to change much if you change it that way. It's still a black mark on a person's record. It still costs them enough money to catch their attention to say, okay, I've had my one chance, this is going to end it.
Okay.
And a reasonable person, I think, would look at it that way. And if you're not, then you're going to have to pay the consequences.
Is the patrol having trouble finding people that want to be troopers in light of these recent incidents involving violence and death of officers?
You know, I don't think it's one specific reason, but yes, we are struggling to get especially minorities. We would like to have a lot more women involved. Women, I can remember when I started back in the Stone Ages, they said that, you know, women, they actually used to carry their gun in a handbag, and they were mainly juvenile officers. That's what they did, was to handle if you arrested a juvenile, or if a juvenile parents were arrested, they would come and take care of the child until they could get a place someplace. And then I saw them evolve into to where they are today, you know. And so I actually saw it twice. I saw it in Chicago, where the ladies that became police officers were not accepted by the policemen.
Mm-hmm.
They were not accepted by the public.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of pioneers. And then I moved from Chicago to Houston's Ford, and there were no women, there were no minorities. I watched them come a second time and saw that the police picked on them the same as they did in Chicago, and the public did not recognize them as officers. I mean, you'd go there with your partner was a female until you get her out of here. I'm not, you know, going to deal with them. I think society has changed now, you know, much for the better, but we still have to strive and watch, you know.
Are female troopers treated as equal partners by those that they interact with?
I would certainly hope so, and I have not seen anything to the contrary here. That when I've been here, they're well respected and have definite different perspective on life. You know, so I mean, it gives you that rounded perspective, and it's something that's drastically needed. Minorities were desperately in need of minorities to join the police department. Because they can help their peers a lot easier than we can help them a lot of times. So that's one of the things that we really strive for. And it's difficult. It's difficult to get these people, you know. One of the challenges of the State Patrol that I didn't have in a lot of the other departments is the geographic area. I mean, you cover the entire state.
Yes.
You think we go all the way from Spooner up north all the way down to Racine. It's such a diverse population, too. I mean, you know, you have the minorities that we have on the department, they don't want to be up in Spooner. They want to be
right
in Kenosha or Racine.
Yeah. Southeast Wisconsin.
They should be. You know, that they should feel comfortable where they're at.
How many minority officers on the patrol?
I know you're going to ask me that. I can't tell you right now.
Okay.
I don't have
a number
right now. Yeah.
Maybe a final question. I want to respect
sure.
your time. What are the issues, looking out over the next 5 years? You've been superintendent for 5 years.
Right.
What are the major issues and challenges facing the patrol over the next 5 years, sir?
Recruitment would be right at the top.
Okay.
Recruiting qualified people that that want to serve and want to be part of this organization. And the budget is always a major hurdle, because we don't generate money, we cost money as a police department. And Secretary Gottlieb, who is the Secretary of Transportation, who is actually the my boss and one that's in the head of the State Patrol,
yes,
he is very diligently always looking for ways to get us the resources that we need, and he's done a very good job, and that's why we're in the position we're in right now. One of the biggest things is we have back-to-back classes now. We just graduated a class, and we've got another class that's in the process of going through the stages right now to pick the ones that we're going to hire in our next class, and that'll be starting shortly. So that's been a big plus for us.
Well, maybe if you were talking to a class of a group of high school seniors,
mm-hmm.
why would you tell them to go into law enforcement?
Well, if you like people, okay, first of all, that's the first thing. You've got to be somewhat outgoing, and you've got to like people, because we're dealing with people, and, you know, you have to be compassionate. There's two characteristics that I always looked for when I was involved in hiring people. One is compassion. You got to have that. You got to be able to help people to get through their troubles, and you can't compound their troubles by you making more troubles for them.
Okay.
And the biggest thing that you need is common sense, you know, and that's something I think society has lost. You got to be able to make quick decisions when you're a police officer, but you also have to have the common sense background to understand why you're making that decision, you know, and that's sometimes very difficult for young people to understand. So.
Very good. Well, Wisconsin State Patrol Superintendent Steve Fitzgerald, congratulations on a very interesting 50-year career in law enforcement.
Thank you.
And thank you for giving Wisconsin Eye the time.
Anytime.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.